see. Okay, can everybody see that?
Yep, you're
Yes.
good.
All right, good deal. All right, hello everyone, and welcome to my masterclass presentation on the history of wireless networks. Within this presentation, we're going to look at the concurrent development of both cellular and Wi-Fi networks and examine how new protocols, technologies, and standards have led to the networks we use so often today. We're also going to examine how they have developed alongside each other. To start, we need to define what a wireless network is. Compared to its cabled counterpart, a wireless network doesn't use any wires or cables to form connections between device and access point. Instead, these networks use electromagnetic waves to transmit data. Some of the benefits of wireless networking include convenience, mobility, and easier setup. When we look around at computer networking today, we can see wireless net solutions nearly everywhere, from homes to offices to cafes to airports to even shopping malls. But the speed and convenience of today didn't pop up out of the blue. So how did we get the modern wireless networks that we use so often? Let's briefly go back to the 19th century and examine the birth of wireless communication. In the late 1800s, Italian inventor Guglielmo Marconi first transmitted radio waves in Italy. A few years later, Marconi was successfully broadcasting messages via Morse code and set up the first wireless communication station in England. Marconi and similar inventors in this era laid the foundation for wireless communication, as these experiments led to the development of radio telegraphy. His discoveries proved the ability to transmit without physical wires and provided empirical evidence for the existence of radio waves. Okay, so the first rudimentary wireless network that could be compared to those today was the invention of AlohaNet in 1971. In the wake of ARPANET, the first public packet switch computer network, AlohaNet subsequently innovated by taking this foundational concept wireless. Developed at the University of Hawaii, this networking system used radio waves to connect computers across the Hawaiian Islands. AlohaNet essentially created wireless packet switching networks and laid the groundwork for the development of modern technologies such as Ethernet and Wi-Fi by introducing random access protocols. Random access allows nodes to send and receive data without taking turns, and this protocol is now widely used in nearly all forms of wireless communications. Overall, AlohaNet was one of the first uses of wireless communication for a data network. Now, running concurrently to wireless computer networks is the invention of cellular technology. So, cellular networks and Wi-Fi networks are both technologies that enable wireless communication, but they operate differently and each serve distinct purposes. Cellular networks are provided by mobile network operators and use a system of interconnected base stations to provide coverage over large geographic areas referred to as cells. In 1947, Bell Labs researchers introduced the concept of cellular communication. In 1973, Martin Cooper, an engineer at Motorola, demonstrated the world's first handheld cellular phone. In 1981, the first fully operational cellular network was launched. And then in 1983, the Advanced Mobile Phone System was introduced in the United States, which was the first nationwide commercial cellular network.
Sorry, one second here. Travis Taylor, I see you in the on the list of people in the meeting. You're supposed to be in the orientation. This is not the orientation meeting, Travis Taylor. Yeah, I'm just gonna remove you from this one because you need to be in the other meeting. It'll be on your calendar on Teams. Okay, sorry about that. Go ahead.
No, you're good. Okay, so from a commercial standpoint, enterprise wireless technology did not gain significant traction until 1985, following the Federal Communications Commission's decision to erase or to ease licensing restrictions across three specific segments of the industrial, scientific, and medical spectrum: the 900 megahertz, 2.4 gigahertz, and 5 gigahertz bands. This regulatory change exempted businesses from the requirement of obtaining individual licenses for transmissions within these spectrum bands. And this change opened up a substantial market opportunity for vendors aiming to deliver fast wireless data networking solutions. And then AT&T was one of the first examples. Okay, the internet and wireless LANs. During the 1990s, the internet's emergence spurred significant advancements in wireless networking. In 1991, the Institute of Electrical and Electronics Engineers, or IEEE, formed a committee to develop the specifications of the Wi-Fi standard. The first version of the Wi-Fi standard, 802.11, was released in 1997, providing wireless connectivity at speeds up to 2 megabits per second. The introduction of WEP in the same year brought rudimentary security to Wi-Fi networks, although this was quickly replaced by WPA. In 1999, updated versions of the 802.11 standard were released by the IEEE, 802.11a and 802.11b. 802.11a aimed at businesses, operated in the 5 gigahertz band and achieved speeds up to 54 megabits per second, while 802.11b targeted at home users, operated in the 2.4 gigahertz band with speeds up to 11 megabits per second. However, compatibility issues persisted among these products. So to address this, a group of vendors formed the Wireless Ethernet Compatibility Alliance in 1999, advocating for standards, compliance, and interoperability for enterprise wireless. This organization rebranded as the Wi-Fi Alliance in 2002. A year later, Wi-Fi networks adhering to the 802.11g standard were introduced, also offering speeds up to 54 megabits per second. Substantial enhancements would arrive with the 2009 release of the 802.11n standard, supporting theoretical speeds of up to 600 megabits per second. This is around the time where mobile phones utilizing Wi-Fi were available, and also portable laptops were becoming more standard for both business and personal use. So as this internet usage expanded, so did wireless connectivity capabilities. 802.11ac, or Wi-Fi 5, was launched in 2013, elevating top speeds to over 1 gigabit per second and enhancing network efficiency and reliability. Building upon these advancements, 802.11ax, or Wi-Fi 6, debuted in 2019, delivering even higher throughput to accommodate more devices and traffic with enhanced reliability. So in parallel with the development of wireless LAN technology, telecommunication carriers continued to develop mobile broadband technologies. And as we mentioned earlier, mobile broadband became possible in the 90s with the shift from first generation consumer cellular service, which was analog, to second generation digital services, which enabled functionalities like texting and early media services. The surge in mobile data demand and prompted carriers to transition to a new generation of mobile data service by the late 90s. 3G introduced LAN-like packet switching systems, deploying technology akin to that in wired and wireless enterprise networks. 3G also facilitated business-centric smartphones like the BlackBerry, personal hotspots, and cellular modems, making mobile access to enterprise systems widely accessible for the first time. Speeds reached up to 2 megabits per second, surpassing dial-up. All right, modern generations. So we've caught back up to Wi-Fi. In the late 2000s and early 2010s, carriers and device manufacturers transitioned to 4G and then 4G long-term evolution technologies, delivering higher speeds up to 100 megabits per second. By the 2010s, 4G LTE services had become ubiquitous in the U.S., empowering remote or traveling employees to work from anywhere, anytime. With 5G, carriers and device manufacturers introduced extensive service enhancements. In general, 5G aims to provide much higher peak data rates and lower latency compared to 4G, and potentially up to 10 gigabits per second. 5G enables ultra-fast download and upload speed and supports applications that require ultra-high bandwidth, such as 4K and 8K video streaming and virtual reality. It's also worth pointing out that both 5G and Wi-Fi 6 use similar technologies and techniques to address challenges related to density, speed, reliability, and power usage. So, when we look at the modern state of wireless networks, I think it's fair to say that both cellular networks and Wi-Fi have helped the other drive innovation in wireless communication. Developments in transmission speed, signal reliability, and coverage in one domain often inspire advancement in the other. And as consumers rely on wireless connectivity in their daily lives, their expectations have gotten more ambitious. This demand has pushed both cellular networks and Wi-Fi providers to improve their services and technologies to meet these progressing needs. For example, the increase in cell phone usage could be viewed as directly responsible for facilitating the high-speed hotspots in airports, malls, and cafes. The growth of IoT devices is another example. Smart cameras and home security systems may use the local network to connect to the internet, while users can access the related app away from their home using a cellular connection. In conclusion, the history of cellular and Wi-Fi networks is filled with technological innovation and evolution, and for better or worse, has shaped the way we all communicate and connect in the modern world. The transition from analog to digital technologies, the emergence of high-speed data transmission, and the ongoing advancements in standards and protocols have propelled cellular and Wi-Fi networks to become indispensable components of our daily lives. There is no doubt that emerging technologies like 5G and eventually Wi-Fi 7 will result in even higher speeds, more reliable service, and a greater degree of connection for everyone across the globe. So thank you all very much. Here are my references. And I will try to fumble my way through any questions.
No questions, man. Well done.
Thank you. Alrighty, well, thank you guys for the opportunity.
That's great, thank you. Yeah, if there's no questions, just going to reiterate, if you're a new intern, this is your first week. I don't see any on from the list, but this is not the correct meeting for you to be in if it's your first week. But besides that, next up on the list is Daisy Trang. Is Daisy here?
Can you hear me?
Yep, I can hear you.
Can you hear me?
Yep.
Somehow I'm not in the presenter. I'm actually on the guest list.
Yeah, so, I see that.
And do you, can I share my screen?
There, you should be good now.
Okay.
Oh, is your presentation recorded?
Yes.
Okay, we can't hear. You have to share with sound when you share. There's a...
I'm sorry?
We can't hear it, so you're going to want to restart it and stop sharing. And then when you hit share again, there is an option to share with audio that will pop up at the top. It'll say share with audio.
Okay.
What is cloud computing? Cloud computing is the delivery of computing services, including servers, storage, databases, networking.
Yeah, it's really hard to, we can't really hear it, and it's
over the internet,
not full screen either, so it's hard to see.
Can you
scale? Before the cloud, you might have backed up your documents.
Yeah, we can't hear it, Daisy. Is there a reason why you're not presenting? Why you're not presenting it live?
That's because I thought I could use the recording. Can you hear me?
Yeah, we can hear you, but we can't hear the presentation. I know some people have presented a recording, but it's typically better to do it live because, yeah, we can't hear it.
Okay, let me see if I could make it louder, because I'm actually I have a Mac, and I've been having problem with that. So I just switched over to my son's computer. Okay, let's see. So do you see the screen or no?
What's that, sorry?
Tell you, okay.
Tonight, I'm going to talk about cloud computing. What is cloud computing?
If you want, I can go ahead and present while she gets herself squared away.
Yeah,
go ahead. Cool.
No worries. Yeah, just take your time. Get it sorted out. How's that look to everyone?
Looks good.
Yep, you're good.
All right. So before we begin, I know this is like a mandatory class for like all of us, or like a meeting for all of us, but I'm a huge advocate for like training to standard, not to time. But in order to move through this pretty quickly, I'll just need some participation from everybody to make it go as fast as possible. Also, since I do have my presentation pulled up, I won't be able to see the chat. So if I ask a question, please enable your audio to answer it. Does everybody feel comfortable with that?
Yes.
Perfect. Yes. All right. Let's get started. Put my mouse back where it needs to be. Now let's get started. All right. So at this point in our careers, we should have at least heard about disaster recovery plans. But I mean, what is it, right? Why is it so important? Well, a disaster recovery plan is a formal document essentially created by the organization that contains detailed instructions on how to respond to unplanned incidents, such as natural disasters, power outages, cyber attacks, and other disruptive events, right? The plan contains strategies to minimize the effects of a disaster so an organization can continue to operate or quickly resume operations. The biggest thing is that it's an essential part of the business continuity plan, which we're working on as one of our projects, and it can be applied to, you know, the aspects of the organization that depend on functioning information technology infrastructure. So how it relates to cybersecurity, which is the, you know, group that I'm in, it's the process of creating that plan for regaining access and functionality to the organization's IT infrastructure after a disaster. All right, so let's talk about disaster for a second. Disaster recovery is a major part of any organization's business continuity plan. It primarily focuses on a company's IT infrastructure and systems during disasters. So the idea is to prevent disruptions in business functions and allow them to run as normal. There are many like risks to our data out there, including fire, natural disasters, as we talked about, snowstorms, tornadoes, earthquakes, power outages, or other connectivity loss, and cyber attacks. And that's just what's, you know, available to like the general public, right? There's, you know, some other things that are, you know, considered threats. And so, like, I know this is like not the most exciting part of cybersecurity, but is often one of the most important aspects. So who can tell me three main benefits of a disaster recovery plan?
Business continuity is one of them.
Yep. Yep. What's another one? Probably like data loss prevention, right?
I would also say reputation, maybe.
Yeah, absolutely. Maintaining client satisfaction. Yep, absolutely. And then what is like the main thing like for like from business continuity standpoint? That downtime, right? So minimizing downtime. All right. So after we've got that covered, then the next thing we'd want to do is conduct a risk assessment. So, and again, at this point, we should all be familiar with risk assessments, at least like the general, you know, understanding of it. But what do you guys think of when you hear risk assessment? What does that mean to y'all?
Basically just a, basically just a test on just how vulnerable your system is or how much at risk is that.
Yeah, absolutely. And like, you know, what the purpose is behind that, right? So like risk assessments, essentially they ensure the health and safety of employees and customers if, you know, you have some, by identifying potential hazards and risks. So, you know, everything from like physical, you know, hazards like tornadoes and stuff, but also, you know, like data loss prevention. So for example, certain risks might determine the type of protective gear or equipment a worker needs in like a physical setting. But like from an IT perspective, that risk assessment may say, okay, like we conducted our risk assessment and we noticed that we had, you know, some routers from 2005, you know, and they no longer support updates. That is a vulnerability. We should probably update those, right? So, but how is this conducted? So a risk assessment is conducted. It varies depending on like the industry. However, for the most part, there's five steps regardless of the business type or industry. So the main number one is identify potential hazards, how they could negatively affect or impact the organization's ability to conduct business. Determine or two, determine what assets would be impacted as a result of that risk. And then three, after you've completed one and two, you'll want to use the risk assessment framework to deploy measures that will reduce or eliminate the effects that risk will have on the organization. Four, as with any project, you'll want to record your findings, processes, and controls that you put in place. And then, you know, they can just be like a rough draft on a notepad, and these will be cleaned up and put into an official document. And then, of course, it isn't a set it and forget it document. It'll need to be reviewed and updated regularly to meet the needs of the organization. All right, so disaster recovery strategies. You know, how can we ensure that we have the information that we need if we lose access to it?
Gotta back it up.
Yes, sir. That's right. Backups. So backups are crucial for ensuring security of important information, such as classified documents or for personal things like family photos in the event of a data loss. So backups create a copy of that data that can be recovered in the event of primary data failure, whether it be hardware or software, data corruption, human-caused events, or even a malicious or accidental deletion of data. I know we are human. These things happen. So by having those redundancies in place, you know, you can really benefit the organization. In fact, it's critical for disaster recovery and continued operations. There are many benefits of using cloud-based solutions. So usability and accessibility, security and costs, as well as sharing and scalability. And then from a disaster standpoint, the biggest benefit is leveraging that cloud for offsite backups and storage. So if you have like a tornado or something, and it, you know, your backups are on site, chances are you're going to have issues with those. So speaking of offsite storage, by having those backups and storage at alternate locations, it could, you know, cost less for the organization as well. All right. So communication plan. So who do you guys think should be, guys in the gender neutral term, who do you guys think should be on the disaster recovery planning team?
IT for sure.
Yep.
Should be someone from management.
Yep. Leadership. Absolutely. Good job, Larry. So yeah, I mean, as with any team, having the right people can make all the difference. And the team should at least be composed of like authorized leadership. And this is to provide direction, governance, and operational authority, organizational expertise. So team members who represent the executive, legal, and regulatory interests, operational expertise. So team members who bring business operation knowledge and interests, as we talked about, Larry had mentioned technical expertise. So, you know, those members who bring technology and IT management expertise, so even like project managers, and then administrative experts. So those will be, you know, basically the ones who administer the disaster response activities. So, and lastly, those team resources should be well informed and well aware of the disaster response plan's goals and objectives. So that way, any significant disaster event that will impact a business as a whole, everybody will have an idea of what's going on, and the whole organization will be represented by the DRP team. So let's talk about training for a second. If you are on a disaster response planning team, do you think that it should be, you know, something that you only look at, you know, once a year?
No.
No, right? So, I mean, even if like, if the project only takes like 4 months and you guys are done with it, you know, you may have to go look at it the following week if there's something that comes up. So just like when a disaster unfolds, there's many consequences for business, loss of employee life or injuries, as like the worst, loss of revenue, and then loss of facilities and equipment, you know, in that order. And so for a disaster communication plan to run smoothly, all people involved need to know what to do. The team handling the communication should present a cohesive strategy with consistent, accurate information. And for this reason, it's critical to assemble a team of responders and identify spokespeople for specific aspects of the plan. Those spokespeople should be well informed about the disaster, display genuine empathy, be prepared to field any questions regarding the disaster, have decision-making authority. And it's also a good idea to have at least one subject matter expert as part of the communications effort. Depending on the disaster type, this could be like a scientist, a public official, or like another specialist in a relevant field. So what are the options for communicating? You know, there's several options, you know, from SMS notification, mobile apps, international communication systems, and internal communications. And these are all great systems that can be used. The instructions can be tailored for specific events, or can be as general as advising personnel to log in their backup form of communication for further instructions. Does anyone think we should rely on just one method of communication for disaster response?
No.
No, right? Yeah, so just like with a defense in depth approach to security, we should have multiple options for communications should they fail. A backup for our backup, if you will. All right, so if someone pulled the fire alarm at your work, gym, or grocery store, what would you do?
Go to the nearest exit.
Yeah. Yeah, depending. We all know this because of our training, right? So we've all had fire drills. So just like with fire drills or active shooters or other disasters, having that training for employees and on the disaster response procedures and protocols is critical to ensure that, you know, when disaster strikes, everybody knows what their roles are and how to be safe. So, but how do we ensure that they know their roles and responsibilities? We covered it on one of the previous slides. I'll give you a hint. It's training. That's right. Training, just like with fire drills and tornado drills, conducting regular disaster response drills can give leadership a better idea of their response capabilities and where they should focus their attention.
It also gives the players practice on what to do in emergencies so that when the time comes, it's muscle memory. Whoop. I guess we're skipping to the end, guys. Well, there's my references. I've got a list of questions that I can ask you guys, but that's pretty much it. Yeah, that's it. I can field any questions. These are the references that I use for the presentation. If you want more information on the topic, I can definitely expand on it. Other than that, this concludes my presentation. Thank you all for being here, and I will be here for the remainder of the class with any questions that you may have.
Thank you.
Yeah, great job. And like Christopher said, good pictures. I liked the Godzilla disaster warning.
Yeah, I got a kick out of that one.
Well, if there are no questions, we will move ahead to Larry Bender, if you're ready.
Right. Hey, how's that?
Yeah, looks good.
Okay. I'm Larry. As you can see from my photo, I'm from a different generation, not a Gen Y or Gen X. So it's interesting to me to see and work with you young people, most of you younger. For most of my life, I've been a veterinarian, and I'm just finishing up now a bachelor's in cloud computing. So it just so happened with our veterinary clinic, we converted to software as a service. Let's get this in. And the process was several steps. We first considered the factors. We'll consider the factors in a decision here, what we went through as veterinarians and managing partners as to why we should do it or shouldn't do it. We'll discuss the process that we went through, and we'll discuss the results, some of the outcomes of the switch. I'm sure you're all familiar with software as a service. That's a type of service where a company, a veterinary company, will provide all of the infrastructure in the cloud, includes everything that's needed to run a veterinary practice, and all we need as a practice then is a terminal, an internet connection. That's all we need. We can contact then our service anywhere where there's internet service. So we already were using technology in quite a few different ways, using a veterinary specialized software for our client records or pet records, email with Google. Of course, there's texting and website that's available too. In-house networking, the invoicing was handled by the software. We do our blood analysis and x-rays and ultrasounds in-house, and those records were scattered. They were not in the client records. They were either with the x-ray or in the blood machine, that type of thing. I'm really open to questions as we're going here too. My presentation isn't real long. I do have a couple fun questions at the end, but that's where we are now. So we looked at this and asked ourselves, where are we not in the cloud that we could be? Well, the proprietary veterinary software holds the client records. Of course, there's confidentiality issues there, pet records. The networking with the SaaS is all in the cloud. Invoicing, and what we wanted or would like would be our blood results and x-rays and ultrasounds to be transferred into the cloud, into the records automatically. good reasons why to move to the cloud. This is really true for almost any business. There is cost savings, especially in the infrastructure costs. Our hardware was beginning to be 12 years old. We had 10 standalone units plus a server. Had replaced some hard drives, but other than that, it was still functioning. The cloud services are more efficient. You pay for a certain amount. However, with a software as a service, we pay a fixed amount each month, and that covers the services. So we can't quite capitalize on that efficiency. It is really nice to access our records, addresses, pet names from anywhere. And we found it very reliable. It's probably a four point instead of a 6 point there, 99.99. I don't think they have gone the full route there. And if needed, our database can be expanded very easily. The cloud service, the company takes care of the backups, encrypted data. They have a service for detecting incidents. Our form of backup was a USB connected backup, which we would take home to another location each night. So it certainly wasn't being backed up more than once a day. Here, this data is backed up by the minute. So the step-by-step process, we did some research as to what veterinary packages were out there. First, we checked with the service that we had, our in-house on-premise, and as it turned out, that was not compatible with being converted to a cloud model. In fact, we found out that it was at an end of life. They were no longer going to provide support for that. So that kind of helped the decision to look for a cloud-based only product. And one thing we had to make sure of course, in a rural area in Wisconsin, to have enough bandwidth to support that type of service. And it turned out that we did at that point. The migration was a process. The company itself, it's called Pulse, converted the data. They uploaded all of our database, which was a SQL type database, converted it. And after they had converted it, they went ahead and started running it on the cloud platform while we continued with our old software. And in doing that, we could log on and practice and get some staff training. And then the process of going live, which was probably the most difficult because it was a one-day procedure. First day we were on our old system, and the next day we were going live with the new cloud platform. Records are still the same. Animals clients are still the same. This type of information we entered is still the same, but in a completely different platform and menu system. So we learned as we went, we adjusted to the changes and started realizing some of the benefits right away. And the big one being the convenience of just logging on anywhere. And then as we learned the software, it can be formatted and changed and adapted to each different veterinary clinic.
Larry, I'm just going to ask, there's a question in the chat that you cannot see, but Owen's asking if veterinary clinics have specific legal requirements, like similar to HIPAA.
The answer is no. We have a lot of other requirements as far as food and drug with the medications that we have, as far as storing them, logging them, and making sure we're in compliance there as far as restricted drugs. As far as confidentiality of client information, like even a neighbor wants to know how his neighbor's pet is doing, it's not ethical to provide that information across. So we're very careful in that regard. But as far as specific laws or regulations, the answer is no. OSHA has their hand in it. They will come for inspections. So we have to be up to code on that. So like I said, it was a steep learning curve. Some people enjoyed it. I enjoyed the process myself, but then we had, you know, of course you have staff members that get frustrated. And if things don't go well, if you have a client waiting, that kind of thing, it's frustrating to staff that want to get good service. I believe as a clinic, it's been 6 months now, and I believe we're to the point where we're very comfortable with it. But for that first month, there was definitely a slowdown in work, and we did some scheduling changes to compensate for that. Any questions right now? You can also expect to, feel accomplished by what you're doing. You're providing your pets with the newest in technology and clients. It's flexible. The updates come automatically. We don't even know about them. The disaster recovery, you don't have to worry about. Maybe we should, but we don't. Their provider, the SAS service provider, is Amazon, which I feel is pretty reliable. And now we have automatic transfer of our x-rays into the pet record, as well as the blood records analysis of that going right in. I don't see a lot of cost saving. I know we're paying about $600 a month for the service, but I do feel it gives us up-to-date capabilities as far as staying competitive and giving good service to our clients. This is just the front end, kind of the appointment page here. I'll just show you a few pages. Up here in on the upper right, you can search for a client by phone or a number of different ways. You can change providers here. We have four veterinarians working at the clinic. This is actually our dog, Annie. She's 13 and a half. Provides information on the client. On Annie, she's a golden retriever. Her weight trend here, right here, that weight dropped. She had cancer of the spleen. And I ended up removing the spleen, and she's doing pretty well now. So a lot of different options here for just jumping to different parts of the software. You can quickly add a medical note. You can create a treatment. You can provide an estimate, print that out. This is to check out when they leave. So just a very nice program, very complete. This is actually our blood machines. This is Shelly. She's running some blood work. You can see the pulse menu there. And this is that record of analysis right in the record. Take your x-rays here, and they pop right into the record. So, do you have any questions? Not, I have a couple for you. Let's talk about our pets. Anybody have a pet?
Got a zoo.
Don't be shy.
I have three cats.
All right.
Got four cats, four dogs, and my wife's actually a veterinarian from Wisconsin as well, so that's funny.
Jameson, you don't have pets, you have a zoo.
Yeah.
That's great. That's great.
Yeah. That's a zoo.
Okay, well, thank you. Thank you for your time.
Yeah, great presentation. Thank you.
Good job, Larry.
All right, after Larry, we have Janina. Are you here and ready to go?
I am right here.
All right.
All right. Can you see my screen?
Yes, we can.
All right. Okay. So, hi, my name is Janina Thompson, and I'm going to be presenting tonight about multi-factor authentication. So, multi-factor authentication has undoubtedly secured one or more of our online accounts by now. And according to CISA.gov, MFA is a security method that involves requiring a user to provide two or more credentials to confirm their identity before logging in. MFA requires users to meet specific criteria or factors to access resources. Adding more factors significantly raises the challenge of impersonating a user. MFA usually requires the utilization of two or more of the following components. First, is knowledge-based authentication. It involves a personal security questions or swiping a debit card and entering your PIN, downloading a VPN with digital certificates, or answering personal security questions. Second is inheritance-based. Any biological characteristics that the user possesses that a user can use to authenticate, like your retina scan, fingerprints, then facial recognition. Then we have the possession base. This specifies something only the user has. So to log in, user needs a badge, token, key fobs, SIM cards, smartphones, or OTP apps. Then we are location based. So location base is geographic or network limits. Users must meet the location conditions in addition to the other factors. Users may access an application within your company's network or within a specific list of countries. And lastly, we have time-based. It refers to any limits that may be implemented to limit authentication hours. Time-based security will not allow users to log in outside of the specific allowed access time. So let's go through MFA evolution. Here's how MFA has evolved to safeguard organizations from cyber threats. So we have the early 80s. RSA introduced the first password-generating key fob in 1986, marking the evolution of a two-factor authentication. Then on the 1990s to 2000s, AT&T developed 2FA over two-way pagers. Though RSA's public key cryptography faced challenges due to cost and complexity. Then in 2000s to 2010s, smartphones popularized MFA, especially with BYOD initiatives, SMS and email authentication made 2FA more accessible, driven by rise. Although with this rise of the smartphones, it kind of like raised up cyber threats. So on 2010s to present, President Obama has hashtag turn on 2FA initiative in 2016, promoted online safety with major tech companies and financial institutions supporting MFA adoption. Biometric and passwordless authentication gained traction, including fingerprint and facial recognition on smartphones, RFID work badges, and passwordless network access via digital certificates. And also, I forgot to mention that adaptive MFA also emerged and allowing authentication methods to adapt based on variables like device type, geography, identity traits, user behavior, enhancing security without replacing traditional MFA. And here you can see examples of security tokens and types of biometric authentications. And you'll be familiar with this. This would be our samples of multi-factor authentication business solutions that we use at work. And what is the future of biometric authentication? So biometric identification solutions have become firmly established in our everyday lives, whether at security checks at airports or through facial recognition on our smartphones. And these are the next generation is already waiting. Here we have the ear shape authentication. This human ear has emerged as an ideal source for passive person identification due to its stable structure since birth. A novel biometric approach known as ear acoustic authentication utilizes reflected sound within the ear. This method employs an earbud type recognition device to measure the geometry of the ear canal. In 2020, the hearable device debuted in Tokyo, representing a technological breakthrough. And they've also announced last year that a new gadget featuring ear acoustic biometric authentication will be available to the public. And they said the estimated delivery launch was supposedly April of 2023 and will only cost $280. Here we have vascular vein pattern recognition. Near-infrared light captures images of blood vessels on the hand or finger. Studies have shown that everyone's vascular pattern remains distinct throughout life, unaffected by age. The potential applications of this technology trace back to 1992. Then 2 years ago, Koncevich, a co-founder and chairman of Red Rock Biometrics, and his team introduced Palm ID. This technology analyzes skin lines and creases to establish unique biometric signatures. And actually last week, when my friend and I went to Whole Foods in New York, here in Union Square in New York City, on the checkout counters, they already have palm scanners. So you just go into the registration, you have a QR code from your credit card, and you'll scan your palm on their scanner, and then you just go into their checkout counter, they'll scan your palm and you pay through your palm. And we have DNA matching. Since the 1980s, DNA technologies, once limited to forensics, have advanced significantly. Recent advancements like rapid DNA technology allow for swift, convenient DNA profiling using mobile devices and automated processes. Very DNA technology, as highlighted by Schindler, enables rapid on-site or remote DNA production. So, why is MFA important? Using MFA improves security against password-related risk, such as phishing and brute force and assaults. It safeguards various systems, including remote access, email, sensitive data, such as financial and medical records, limiting illegal access. MFA is also critical for national security, since government entities use it to protect sensitive data. So do you guys remember about the Colonial Pipeline attack? So it was caused by a compromised dormant VPN account that lacked an MFA. So because of the recent exponential surge in the cyber incidents, cybersecurity insurance carriers have made an MFA a prerequisite for obtaining coverage. President Biden's Executive Order 1402 requires zero trust cybersecurity and phishing resistant MFA to improve digital system security. And then utilizing a single sign-on eliminates the need to generate a password for each application, while the integration of MFA streamlines the login process and facilitates secure remote entry on the organization's network. Here we have a cybersecurity resilience bell curve. I got this from the Microsoft Digital Defense Report of 2023 that they released last October. As you can see here, for 2023, it still shows that the basic security hygiene protects against 99% of the attacks, and the top key factor is enabling MFA. And on the same report, Microsoft also reported that cyber criminals use cyber crime as a service to scale phishing and DDoS attacks. But of course, there will always be challenges. So these are the MFA implementation challenges and solutions. First, inaccurate MFA implementation could negate the organization's cyber insurance. As I said earlier, now you would require MFA to get cybersecurity insurance. Then, modernizing apps before moving to the cloud is time-consuming and costly. Optional MFA leads to poor adoption, but you'll always have mandatory implementation to ensure acceptance. Cutting corners in MFA implementation poses risk, but you have limited scope is insufficient. Then you have user friction. So we'll introduce adaptive MFA based on context reduces this. SMS authentication is insecure. So you'll have biometrics, security keys, and magic links will make it better. Passwords are weak. We have the biometrics, phone keys, or magic links offer stronger options. Then overlooking MFA's impact on business, lack of executive support and user understanding always delays MFA implementation. And deploying all at once is not a great idea. MFA should roll out, should be gradual, focusing on high-risk apps and users first. And not implementing MFA on legacy applications. We can always identify orchestration platforms that can help implement MFA on those legacy apps. And to sum it up, by adding extra verification layers like biometric information or one-time codes, MFA has improved security beyond passwords. As a result, the risk of unwanted access has been reduced and sensitive information has been successfully protected. However, these developments can also cause complexity and usability problems, especially if there are few hacked authentication factors. Ethical issues occur when it comes to guaranteeing inclusivity for people with impairments or limited authentication alternatives, as well as striking a balance between security and user ease. So to counter evolving cyber threats, adopting strong security measures, such as using MFA wherever possible, creating strong and unique passwords, updating security settings, being alert for phishing efforts is critical. A safer online environment can be achieved by supporting moral and inclusive MFAs, easily accessible authentication techniques. And additionally, MFA skills can be improved by utilizing machine learning and artificial intelligence. AI algorithms are used by adaptive multi-factor authentication requirements in response to risk assessments. Security is strengthened by this proactive strategy, which constantly adjusts to threats and user behaviors. And these are my references. And that should be it.
Right on. Thank you. Does anybody have any questions?
No, good job.
So I'm going to bring things back to Daisy Trang. Are you, you think you have a solution or are you still working on things?
Let me see if this works, okay?
Okay.
Does it work now?
We're not seeing your screen.
Okay, where is it?
I see we have a question.
Yes, hello, good evening. Yes, I do.
Hello.
I am a little bit kind of lost. I don't know if I'm lost or confused. First of all, is this the IT-296 class?
This is the master class for the internship. It's a weekly meeting that we have where students present their master class. Did you go to the orientation meeting?
No, I think I started a class yesterday. And, you know, I've been trying to catch up with a lot of information. I think the only thing that I'm tracking was on Monday, Tuesday, 8:30 p.m. and 10 p.m. So I was just going through my emails and I saw this. I was like, oh, I don't know. I'm totally confused. So is this IT-296 or maybe I'm in the wrong class? I just saw the link and I decided to join.
This is the PGIP internship. Like, instead of doing the capstone, you can do the internship. So maybe I don't remember the numbers, but the orientation was an hour ago. It's a different meeting than this one.
Okay.
There should be a recording of it. We gotta get through this masterclass. You should have an email with your team lead. Reach out to them either on Teams or email.
Okay. All right. Thank you.
Yeah.
Maybe no I would just stay so that way, if I'm in the right class, I don't have to miss a lot. But so right now, you don't know if this is for associate, masters, or bachelors. You know what this class is all about. If it is for masters, associate, or at least that way, I can have a good head of where I am.
This internship has associates, bachelors, and people doing their masters all combined into one. If you chose to do the internship,
mm-hmm.
then like this meeting is it's an optional meeting that we have every week. Students will have to present at some point, but yeah.
Okay. All right. Thank you. I would just hang around.
Yeah, if you want, I would just recommend getting in touch with your team lead and trying to find the orientation recording. It's on Teams.
Okay, all right, thank you.
No problem.
So do you guys see it?
We can see it. It's partially cut off, though, actually.
Okay, how about this? Tonight I'm going to talk about cloud computing. What is cloud computing? Computing is the delivery of computing services, including servers, storage, databases, networking, software, analytics, and intelligence over the internet to offer faster innovation, flexible resources, and economics of scale. Before the cloud, you might have backed up your documents, photos, or music to an external device like a CD-ROM or to your computer hard drive. Now you can back up all that information to the cloud. There are three main types of cloud computing: private cloud, public cloud, hybrid cloud. Private cloud is a cloud infrastructure that is solely used by one organization. It gives organizations greater control over security. It can be hosted internally or externally. Private clouds are great for organizations that have high security demands and high management demands. Public cloud is a type of hosting in which cloud services are delivered over network for public use. Customers do not have any control over the locations of the infrastructures. The cost is shared by all users and is either free or in the form of license policy like pay per user. Public clouds are great for organizations that require managing the host applications and the various application users use. Hybrid cloud uses both private and public clouds, but can remain separate entities. Resources are managed and can be provided either internally or by externally providers. A hybrid cloud is great for scalability, flexibility, and security. An example of this is an organization that can use the public cloud to interact with customers while keeping their data secure through a private cloud. There are three main types of cloud computing: infrastructures as a service, IaaS. IaaS contains the basic building blocks for IT. It typically provides access to networking features, computers, virtual or dedicated hardware, and data storage space. IaaS gives you the level of flexibilities and management control over your IT resources. It is most similar to the existing IT resources with which many IT departments and developers are familiar. Software as a service, SaaS, provide you with a complete product that is run and managed by the service provider. In most cases, people refers to SaaS are referring to end user applications, such as web-based email. With a SaaS offering, you don't have to think about how the service is maintained or how the underlying infrastructure is managed. You only need to think about how you will use that particular software. Platform as a service, PaaS. PaaS removes the need for you to manage underlying infrastructure, usually hardware and operating system, and allow you to focus on the deployment and management of your application. This helps you be more efficient as you don't need to worry about resource or planning or maintaining, patching, or any heavy lifting involving running your application. Cloud provider. The most popular cloud provider are Amazon Web Services, also known as AWS, Microsoft Azure, Google Platform Cloud, GPC. Major companies are using cloud. For example, Netflix, Epic Games, Facebook are using Amazon Web Services, AWS. PayPal, Intel, Yahoo are using Google Cloud Platform, GCP. And Samsung, Pixar, eBay are using Microsoft Azure. Here's a video that I wanted to show you on the history of cloud computing.
In the early mid-90s, cloud computing has become a mainstay of modern work, life, and leisure. The origin of the term cloud computing can be traced back to early network schematics, where the appearance of overlapping server icons resembled the billows of clouds. Soon, a cloud-like shape came to be synonymous with areas on a network that required little explanation in order to understand the diagram as a whole. And by 1996, companies such as Compaq Computers had begun to develop internal use marketing strategies around these so-called cloud services: software as a service, platform as a service, and infrastructure as a service. Outside of the drawing room, the cloud is a metaphor for segments of a network that can be accessed from any number of devices through the internet. Each segment utilizes the concept of virtualization, where one or more physical servers can be configured individually, but appearing to the user as a single physical device. Much like a traditional utility such as electricity, Cloud services are set up on a pay-per-use basis, monitored across the grid, where services can be scaled or diverted to meet changing consumer needs, while continuing to utilize the same basic resources. The history of the internet itself goes back as far as the early 1960s, with research into packet switching, online transaction processing, and the development of ARPANET. By 1986, interconnected internets were popping up in research and education institutions all across the United States, and were gaining a foothold in Europe as well. By the mid-1990s, Time magazine was calling it the strange new world of the internet. The period was marked by the founding of a number of internet-based companies known as dot-coms that led to a time of unprecedented economic growth. But by the start of the new millennium, the dot-com bubble had burst, and many companies were scrambling to create efficiencies in their data centers that could rein in the huge expense that the internet had become. Then in late 2003, a small Amazon.com development team in a satellite office in South Africa presented a paper to Chairman and CEO Jeff Bezos that took a more innovative approach. What if, the group envisioned, they could build a system that was made up of largely web-based services, and that was fully automated, requiring less systems maintenance, and that could be used by developers as a resource in their more complex applications. The idea was a hit. Amazon Web Services launched as a full-blown service in 2006, with a number of companies adopting the platform as a low-cost, flexible alternative to internal IT initiatives. Soon, any number of competing devices and services would pop up to meet growing consumer demand for what was now being called the cloud. Demand for services quickly growing. By 2008, and with capital investments by wireless and cable companies leading to increases in speed and reliability of networks, what once seemed like science fiction was now a feasible reality. A fast and inexpensive internet that could be used by anyone, practically anywhere. And the rest, as they say, is in the clouds.
You know, you could use this time to be studying your verses.
Oh, got a hot mic, Joseph.
So that was my report. Did you guys see it?
Yeah, we could. It was a little cut off on the right side, but it was good enough. We could see and hear it, so that's good. Glad everything worked out.
I'm sorry. Okay, thank you.
Yeah, thank you. Joseph? Joseph Brady.
Hi. Sorry.
Yeah, hot micing.
Sorry about that. I didn't realize.
No problem. All right, Juan Ortiz.
Hi, I'm here. I have zero idea. I've never presented on Teams before.
Okay, yeah. So up in the top right, there's the beside the leave. It's share, and then you can select whichever window, or you can just share a screen if you want to do that.
Okay, I'll save this. Oh, I have to save it to the cloud. Yeah, whatever.
And if you have any sort of videos and need to share audio, you'll have to do that after you share the window.
Oh, no, I have no anything.
All right.
Okay, so you're about to present. Pairing my slides, loading my presentation. All right, so it looks like I can see the text too. So I can. All right.
Yep, looks good on our end. Gaber.
Hi, everyone. My name is Juan Ortiz. Today, I'm going to be talking about social algorithms and proposing the smartphone question. So first, I'd like to take a minute and ask the audience. You could text it. You can shout it out. Whatever. I don't mind. I can see it. I can see the text log. What is the first thing that comes to your mind? Maybe what you're going to have for dinner, what you're going to do tomorrow night. Favorite drink. Just tell me what's the first thing that is on your mind.
Sleep.
Yeah, I was going to say.
Sleep, food, what kind of food?
I want a nice cheeseburger.
Cheeseburgers.
Tortas.
Tortas? Oh, yes. Very delicious. For me, I'm thinking of fried chicken. I'm thinking about having a nice box of Raising Cane's with their slightly crispy fried chicken and Texas toast and nice sauce. But when I'm thinking of Raising Cane's, and I just say, damn, I really want some Raising Cane's right now, I go on Facebook, I start my doom scrolling, and next thing I know, I get slapped with an ad on Facebook about a value deal from Raising Cane's. That chicken box is $5.99. I'm like, wow, I really need to get it. The point I'm trying to illustrate here is that sometimes people think of things only for their phones to also present the same things to them automatically. So I wanted to answer, why is that so? This presentation will be dedicated to answering the question, why does my phone know so much about what I want? So to start answering that question, we need to learn about social media algorithms. An algorithm is a series of instructions designed to solve specific problems or do certain things. For computers, an algorithm might be used to sort objects or locate data inside of the system. For social media, the algorithm is used to solve the problem of overwhelming us with content, as is what typically happens when no filters are in place for information. Social media algorithms are crucial in giving users constant content to engage with, while also determining its validity, its placement, and if the material itself is compatible with our preferences. These kind of algorithms are the reasons why consumers end up seeing personalized or curated content. So if social media algorithms are responsible with giving us curated content, how can they know so much about us? How can they personalize our experience knowing so little about us? The answer comes from user engagement. Facebook, for instance, sees we're playing their game. And naturally, they're taking notes on how we play because they want us to keep playing. If there's no engagement, there's no means to keep us there. So one of the ways they study up on our tendencies is by attempting to trap us in an endless stream of content, throwing videos and other material at us to force us to keep watching. This trap can also be compounded by basic social norms and pressures, compelling us to watch things based on certain obligations we might have to our friends and family. I'll get into these pressures on the next slide. Let's list a few of these. So anyone who is familiar with TikTok or Instagram knows that you can't pause videos. If you treat these reels like normal videos, you'll end up muting them instead of pausing them. After a few loops, thinking you're tired of the first video, they'll give you a new one. Within minutes, they've got you engaged. Secondly, has anyone heard of the term scene zoning? Scene zoning is when you read your friend's messages with no intent to reply. A lot of people I know take offense to that. So if someone sends you funny videos, you kind of have an obligation to respond. But by doing so, the algorithm has a chance to study you. It's also harder to disengage from a social media network when you have substantial investment in your profile. Perhaps if you're a content creator or a meme page, you must engage with others to gain more material for your account, not to mention the amount of fame you'll lose if you drop off the map. Lastly, the algorithm can send content that confirms your own beliefs. When this happens, it creates an echo chamber. And it's hard to break away from a biased realm that will always tell you that you're right. These are just some of the ways that social media can get you hooked and make you just another test subject. Now let's address the issue. At the end of the day, the reason for why our phones are so smart, practically psychic if I'm being honest, is us. In the real world, thoughtless browsing and searching can allow social media to bring you targeted ads, as they're always tracking what you're searching for. In the case of thinking of things and your phone somehow thinks the same things as you, they don't actually tap your microphone as some people might believe. I thought that when I was studying this. Instead, if a friend is searching for the same things that they talk to you about, the algorithm may push its luck by giving the same ads they have to you. But here's the weird thing about this. Let's consider two guys, Carl and John. They're talking about their favorite place to get some fried chicken, but John is a mukbang vlogger on YouTube, so you know he's all about fried chicken. By comparison, Carl only uses social media to check in with friends and family, so he doesn't use it as much as John does. They start talking about, you guessed it, Raising Cane's when they get together. Now they chat a little bit and then they go home afterwards, but when Carl gets home, he doesn't type in anything about Raising Cane's. In theory, he shouldn't get ads about it, right? Because he's not engaging with Facebook talking about Raising Cane's. Well, consider this. John has geolocation on, and he's been frequenting the Raising Cane's right next to the Walmart down the street. Because Carl and John have been frequently seen together, the algorithm may take a chance and give John's ads to Carl to get him hooked. In conclusion, ads can be suggested based on the interest your friends have, but the kicker is that location data is also valuable to the algorithm in giving you personalized content. I'd like to take a moment to say that if you are a friend that has geolocation on your device, I'd like to ask you, what are you doing? Geolocation is a security risk if you haven't known, and I suggest you Google how to turn it off in your device's settings as soon as humanly possible. After this presentation, of course, your attention should be on me. Now, let's look at what this issue means now and for our future. As you may know, artificial intelligence, or AI, is now a mainstay in algorithm design and our own lives. I personally started using AI to help me with my writing and simply checking my ideas. I don't want to torture my friends to be my beta readers, so, you know, what can you do? But it's just so ubiquitous, ever-present. LinkedIn, for instance, uses AI to offer job recommendations and networking opportunities. It can be customer service. There's whole services that allow you to talk to AI bots role-playing as your favorite fictional characters. It's crazy. It's evident that AI can do so much instantly, replacing people previously in charge of pushing personalized content. But the problem comes in the fact that AI is still human. It's still like us. Thus, it's still susceptible to our own biases. It's even possible for people to make deepfakes of famous people and have them influence the public this way. A good example is last month, if you've been following the election craze, a Democrat last month in January made an AI deepfake of Joe Biden telling people to skip the U.S., not U.S. primary, New Hampshire primary and save their vote for November. The implications of these possibilities evolving in the future could very well mean that AI could incite chaos with more evolved fabricated events. Next, let us assess how ethical this issue is. As we know, AI algorithms can end up creating echo chambers for users based on aggressively predicting the type of content we like. These algorithms that are designed for maximum engagement can create addictions to content because of how it self-confirms our biases. In addition, influencers that share our outlooks could very well expose us to extreme political viewpoints as we connect with the person we're watching. Lastly, some studies show that social media pushes and rewards the viewing of extreme videos, leading to public misinformation and political radicalization. I have a quote from Chamath Palihapitiya, who was the former vice president of user growth at Facebook, to emphasize how unethical this sounds. I feel tremendous guilt. The short-term dopamine-driven feedback loops that we have created are destroying how society works. Now, to conclude, I'll ask the question again. Why do our phones know so much about what we want. In conclusion, the answer is us. Phones get smarter the more information we give it, based on how much we engage with their content. Because of how algorithms are fueled by participation, social media apps are aggressive in pushing content to us to keep us engaged. They push targeted ads to us based on our preferences and our friends' preferences, as well as where we might be at the time. With the advent of AI, it exacerbates, emphasizes the problems of promoting incitement and the creation of echo chambers. Unfortunately, we will have to deal with intrusive algorithms and clairvoyant smart devices for as long as this age of technology persists. The only solution to escape from these intrusive data collection schemes is to just unplug. Yet, taking a detox from the virtual world is a nuclear option not many people want to take. But, like a famous movie says at the end, the only winning move is not to play. Thank you very much. Here's my references. I hope you learned something.
Awesome. I have one that is very enlightening because my coworker and I were just talking the other day about some external portable displays for our laptops. And I was telling him about this one I saw that had two screens that connected through a single USB and how cool it was. And then he told me the very next day that it popped up all over his phone.
Oh, yeah. That is scary.
Hey, Quan, I do have a question for you. This is Miguel, by the way. So how do you think, I mean, because, you know, we can educate people, right, about how to not add information to algorithms and how to not put their information out there. But what more do you think could be done? Like, do you think there needs to be regulations that are made? Do you think there need to be industry standards that need to be established? Like, what would your opinion be of that?
That is a tough question, and it's a feeling question, so I can't answer it. But I do think that there should be some industry standard when it comes to social media networks and even other people handling user data. Like, when you start getting into people's location data, when people have geolocation on, it does open up a lot of unethical value to the situation. I feel like if there was some way to maybe minimize the amount of tracking that these networks can do in order to engage people in their content, it'd be more ethical for these networks to do what they do all the time. But it's a very touchy subject, and I don't think there's any real room to change because of just how much it's evolved.
I know with my phone, every app, I just got a new phone, so every app is asking permissions. And thankfully, well, with Samsung S24 or whatever I got, it'll ask whether or not I allow it to track my location. And there's an option for only while the app is in use. So maybe that's one thing they're trying, whether or not you trust that they're actually not tracking you at that point. But
yeah. I get super scared when apps ask me about my location. Like, I used to play this game called Monster Hunter Go, which is just Pokemon Go with a Monster Hunter flavor and a bigger possibility of you getting hit by a car. So it always asks me if you want, like, your little pet to collect materials for you while you're out of the app, you should always have your location on. And I was like, okay, what could go wrong? And I had my location on for about a whole month. And the problem is, what happens when you have an app like that and it gets compromised? And a malicious actor can just track you anywhere. And I've even done digital forensic courses where the devices did have geotagging on their photos. And it was enlightening, but also scary. Like, a person can just go to great lengths just to track you down. It's just, I think the whole data thing about collecting data is just very strong, and it's very underlooked on how strong it could be.
Yeah, definitely. It's an interesting subject, but in the interest of time, unless anybody's got more questions, we can move on to the next presenter. Thank you again. And we'll go to Amanda, and then just one more after this.
All right, thank you. Just getting my screen shared here.
Yep, you got it.
All right. Good evening, everyone. Tonight, my presentation is on technology in the world of animal rescue. All right, and the agenda for tonight, it's going to be a brief introduction. I'll go over some areas of opportunity and then over some current technology being used in animal rescue, what the future of technology looks like in animal rescue, and then a brief summary. So introduction, the pet industry, it's a booming business in the United States, and animal rescues and shelters are a vital but underdeveloped part of the pet industry that needs drastic improvements. There are approximately 10,000 animal rescues and shelter organizations in the United States, and most are severely underdeveloped when it comes to funding, infrastructure, healthcare, and just general operations. Since roughly 6 million animals enter the animal shelter system each year, there is a great urgency to address the issues facing these organizations, and technology is proving to be a vital part of the necessary development for these organizations. So, for some areas of opportunity, before we know how technology can help improve the development and conditions of shelters and animal rescues nationwide, it's important to understand areas of opportunity. So, first, funding. Funding is a major concern for both privately funded animal rescues and publicly funded animal shelters. So the funding for animal shelters is mostly reliant on how much the local government can fund, while private animal rescues mostly rely on their donor base for funding. The lack of funding can contribute to issues like overcrowding, inadequate housing, and poor adoption rates. Next is public relations, where a majority of animal shelters and rescues have been behind the times when it comes to how they reach the public, mostly relying on basic websites and simple social media posts to get the word out about adoptable animals and volunteer needs and fundraising opportunities. And this also ends up tying into the adoption process, which has historically relied on people coming in person to see adoptable animals. And then it takes days, sometimes weeks, to be approved and adopt an animal, especially when it comes to adopting from private animal rescues. The last two areas of opportunity identified are healthcare and overall organizational operations. The animals in care at shelters and rescues need access to affordable, flexible health care in order to be able to be adopted. So lack of available health care can be the difference between an animal being adopted or languishing in a shelter. And then probably the largest area of opportunity for animal shelters and rescues is how their organization is operated. Since so many organizations are far behind the times and still using outdated technologies, or sometimes none at all, this means that these organizations are not keeping track of valuable data like intake rates, intake types, animal return rates, complaint histories, breed preferences, and adoption success rates. So now that we have identified plenty of areas of opportunity for technology to help improve animal shelters and rescues, I'm going to take a look at four exciting ways technology is currently helping the state of these organizations, starting with the Adoptimize app. So let me play you a brief video first.
Adoptimize is an animal shelter software that takes the shelter out of shelter photos.
Can you guys hear that, or is that too low?
For me, it's a little low.
A little low. Okay, let me.
Yeah, a little quiet.
A little quiet. Let me try turning up my volume. Hopefully that will help. Okay.
Adoptimize is an Adopt-Mize is an animal shelter software that takes the shelter out of shelter photos.
Still pretty low, Amanda.
It is? Okay.
Yeah, if you go to your sound, there's a volume mixer. If you right-click on it, or...
Click on that little thing next to the volume slider.
Yeah.
Would it be go to settings?
Possibly. Every computer seems to identify that one a little bit differently.
Right.
So mine actually has where it'll show me all my open apps, and I can adjust the sound for each one within that.
Oh, yeah, I don't know if it's going to have that.
If you try right-clicking the sound icon, like, at the bottom, like, at the very bottom, just right-click open volume mixer. And...
Maybe system sounds?
It shouldn't be system sounds.
It would be the Microsoft Teams one at the bottom, but it's maxed out.
Bummer. Okay. Sorry, it's going to be a little low, but it's a quick video. I promise.
Yeah, we'll okay. Nobody talks. Everybody cranks their heads.
Yeah, sorry.
Adopt-Mize is an animal shelter software that takes the shelter out of shelter photos. I'm going to give you a quick demo of the Adopt-Mize technology via the free Adopt-Mize Foster web app that works on both desktop and mobile devices. We're going to use this image of Mindy at intake at Stockton Animal Services. On foster.adoptmize.co, click upload photo at the bottom of the page. Fill out your information, your name, shelter, email, and your pet.
Hey, did you get a $10 on your PayPal at 8:30?
Hold on, let me check.
Joseph.
Or things in the folder. Choose your file and upload your image. Adopt-Mize sends you a verification email. There are no accounts for Adopt-Mize Foster to make it really simple for you. All you have to do is click. At this point, Adopt-Mize starts processing your image. We show you cute GIFs while we work our magic. The process takes about 15 to 30 seconds. Ta-da! Here's our cute girl, and you can see her original image below. You can always select a different color. Adorable. The last step is to email yourself the image by clicking the edited photo. That's it. It's designed to be fast and simple so you can spend time on other more important things.
So pretty straightforward, but the idea is super powerful. Some of the agencies that have used this have seen dramatic improvements in their adoption rates. And some examples here include El Paso Animal Services, which saw a 24% higher adoption rate and 105% higher reclaim rate, which ended up saving the organization over $500,000 in care costs. Stockton Animal Services saw a 79% higher adoption rate, and the Palm Valley Animal Society saw dramatically higher click rates for pet profiles using Adopt-Mize versus their standard profiles. So next we have Dubert. Dubert is an online software platform specifically built for animal rescuers and is the only foster home management system currently on the market. Dubert was created by Chris Roy in 2014 and since then has grown to support over 1,200 rescues and over 20,000 volunteers in the United States. Dubert offers many features, including Foster Space, where foster homes can easily connect with the animal organization they are fostering for, Case Management, where users can create their own follow-up workflows that run automatically, Rescue Tube, where videos of adoptable animals can easily be uploaded via the free Dubert mobile app. The system also has the option for rescues to create fundraising events for specific animals, and then any funds are automatically deposited into the rescue's PayPal account. Lastly, Dubert is the only software system that is able to help manage multiple types of volunteer-based transport, which is a vital part of rescuing high-risk animals. Next, we have Vets Plus More. Vets Plus More is a telehealth app that animal rescue organizations can use to get convenient vet services over text or video calling instead of having to always have an in-person appointment. Vets Plus More offers animal rescue organizations the ability for foster homes to connect with vets quickly for advice, saving time and money, and can assist new adopters with transitioning their new adopted pet into the home. The first few months in a new home is a sensitive time for both the new pet and adopters, so being able to support this process can help reduce the chance of the pet being returned. There's also the added benefit of the rescue organizations being able to resell the package through Vets Plus More to the new adoptive home for additional revenue. Finally, there is the Woof Tracks app, which allows users to download the free app and support their favorite charity every time they walk their dog. Eligible 501c3 organizations and animal shelters can become a Woof Tracks partner, and then users can find them on the app to select to support. So every time the user goes on a walk, they are sending money to the charity they support, which helps promote, you know, healthy exercise, as well as increase the user's awareness of the charity they're supporting. And on average, it does take about 25 walks to buy a meal for an average-sized dog at a rescue. So the app promotes users to invite friends and family to walk too, and you can create a group in the app. And then all the earned donations are then sent quarterly to the charities. The future of technology and animal rescue is seeing the emergence of new technologies that can drastically help our ability to save more animals. So advanced technologies like the use of drones and artificial intelligence can help provide valuable surveillance information and crisis response coordination. One example is during the terrible Australian wildfires in 2020. The use of AI actually helped reduce rescue time by 20% and maximized positive outcomes. Innovative technologies like smart collars can help better monitor an animal's health and location. Virtual reality has already been used to help educate people on conservation issues, and it can help to do the same thing for animal rescues and shelters. And finally, mobile technology is continuing to provide innovative ways of saving animals' lives. One example being the app Pets and Go, which allows for crowdsourced reporting and tracking of lost animals using a digital ledger, which has helped increase the reunion rates of lost pets and their families. So in summary, the world of animal rescue is still behind technologically, but luckily there are current applications and software available to help support better organizational operations, fundraising, adoption process, and healthcare so more animals can thrive. And continuing to innovate and adopt better technological processes will ensure a brighter future for the world of animal rescue. I just want to say thank you for listening to my presentation, and these are my references.
Amanda, I absolutely love your presentation. My parents run a large breed dog rescue in Indiana, and they've been looking for ways to increase their business.
Oh,
and
wonderful.
I would love to pick your brain on that. I'm actually looking at coming back as a GITA mentor so that I can work on a project within the internship. I've already started getting the ball rolling on it to help them build a website, to help them build their business and really get things going. Because it is a nonprofit that. And they're completely funded by donations.
Yes. And yeah, this is a topic that's near and dear to my heart. I've been on boards before and in animal rescue and everything. So that's amazing. I would love to be a part of that. So yeah, absolutely reach out. I'd love to help.
A message on the side. So when you get a chance, just hit me back and I'll tell you about some of the ideas so far.
Awesome. Yeah, that sounds fantastic. I love it. Any other questions or anything?
I was just going to say one thing, Amanda. I'm actually from El Paso. And one of the cool things that the animal shelter does is they have a lost and found section, you know, like on their website and I think on their app. And it's got what's called the Pet Finder map. So basically, if the animal's chipped, they're able to post a picture of the animal with the name, you know, its home, like basically its information and where it was found.
I love that. Yeah, because it really, it's huge being able to quickly pair the animal or get the animal back to their home instead of having to have them in a shelter. And yeah, and as someone who has a dog that likes to wander sometimes, even with a fenced yard, you know, it's always like on my mind having him run away and then all of a sudden not being able to find him and everything. So that kind of technology for being able to reunite pets with their families is just amazing.
Speaking of technology for that, I recently got a dog tag for my dog off of Amazon. It just has a QR code on it, but it's keyed into a website. And then anytime somebody scans that QR code, it notifies me of their position.
Oh, wow. Wow.
Kind of cool, because if my dog gets loose wandering the neighborhood, they scan that QR code to figure out who she belongs to, and then I get a notification as soon as they do it.
That's perfect. Yeah, that's the kind of location tracking that I can get behind.
So, Amanda, how many pets do you have?
I have three different dogs, all rescues and different ages, but yeah, they're just a big mob over here. I'd have more, but it's just not feasible at this time.
Good for you.
Thank you. And thank you guys for your attention and everything. I appreciate it.
Good job.
Yeah, great. Great presentation. Thank you. All right. And last but not least, we got Zygmunt.
Yes. Hello.
Hello.
Let's see if I can get this going. All right. Is that showing up correctly?
Yeah, we can see.
All right, we'll just get right into it. This is artificial intelligence in video games. My name is Zig. I hope you guys all find this topic as interesting as I did. So first, let's define our topic. We'll be talking about game AI, specifically the programming behind NPC behavior, the stuff that helps NPCs decide where to go and what to do. Pathfinding and decision trees are two of the most basic aspects of this, but there's a lot more that goes into it, as you'll see. One thing to note is that I won't be going over some things like procedural content generation or player experience modeling, even though some consider these to be part of game AI. I also won't be discussing AI made to play games from an external perspective like a player. There's also quite a difference between game AI and AGI, which is AI designed to be able to perform any mental task a human can. There's a big gap between AI developed for academia and video game industry, so quite a large difference there. For game developers, the purpose of game AI is to improve gameplay. It really only needs to be good enough to make a better game experience for the player. Developers are often constrained by time and hardware. So game AI just needs to provide the illusion of intelligence. It doesn't have to actually be intelligent. In one developer's experience, game AI is only 1/3 proper algorithms. The rest is hacks and heuristics. In fact, there's a lot that goes into game AI that isn't even AI. Players will judge a game's AI on things like whether a guard reacts to their presence, such as with a startled animation and a who's there. On the other hand, if a guard doesn't react or NPCs are seen doing odd things like walking into walls, players will judge the game AI as bad. Players will also consider a game to have bad AI if NPCs are obviously cheating, like if they can create extra resources out of nothing or teleport around. One interesting anecdote I found is from the development of the popular FPS Halo. During playtesting, they found that simply giving enemies more health caused players to report the AI as more intelligent. So the percentage of that, of players who reported that they were more intelligent, went from 8% to 43%. So quite a large jump in that. And all they did was change the amount of health, how many bullets it took to kill the enemies. So here's the first of four real-world game examples of AI I'll talk about. This is an old classic, Pac-Man. Most of you may know, but Pac-Man, basically, you run around a maze and you try to eat up all these little pellets while being chased by ghosts. All of the gameplay comes from the ghosts. There's four of them. They each have a sort of different personalities. And the way this was programmed was, for one thing, they have a finite state machine, which is a construct where an object, in this case a ghost, has a finite number of states that it can be in. And these three states for Pac-Man is scatter, chase, and frightened. Frightened is caused by Pac-Man eating a bit of fruit. The ghosts become frightened, and then he can eat them. And they try to run away from him. The other two modes are scatter and chase. They begin with scatter, and then they go into chase. There's a timer between the two, and it sort of loops. So during the game, there's sort of waves that happen. The game stage is divided into tiles, and each ghost has a target tile that they try to reach. Whenever they enter a new tile, the ghost decides which direction to go based on which will bring it closer to the target tile. So in this example here with the image, you can see that the ghost is coming into a new tile, and he has two options, to go left or right. His target is the red square below, and the green lines represent, you know, the evaluation going on. So in this case, it's going to say, oh, if I turn right, the path to the red square is shorter. So even though it's actually a longer path, it will take that path because of that evaluation. So that's the general AI for these. They have a target tile they try to reach and the evaluation that goes into them. Each of the ghosts has a unique personality, sort of. The first ghost, Blinky, the red one, directly chases Pac-Man, so his target is always the tile that Pac-Man is actually occupying. So as Pac-Man moves, Blinky will try to reach the new tile. Pinky, the pink one, tries to ambush Pac-Man by getting ahead of him. And so Pinky does this by targeting the tile, I think it's either two or four tiles ahead of Pac-Man. So in effect, Pinky will try to ambush him. Inky is described as whimsical in the Japanese, the original one. And he's hard to predict, and I'll go into that in a second. Clyde is seen as like the slow one. He feigns ignorance in the Japanese and sort of changes his mind. So to go deeper into depth on this, Clyde will chase Pac-Man just like Blinky, the red one, until Clyde gets within eight tiles, at which point they'll go into scatter mode, where they'll try to retreat to a target tile. And so each ghost has a target tile that's just beyond the one corner of the map. And you can see in the lower left there on the orange, there's a square that's outside the map. That's actually interesting too, because by putting the tile somewhere unreachable, because of the way the ghost evaluates what path to take, the ghost will kind of loop around because they can never actually reach that tile. And they also can't go backwards unless certain conditions are met. Inky, however, has a very, possibly the most unique targeting method here. Inky picks a spot based on both Pac-Man's location and Blinky's. So Inky will pick a spot you'll take the spot that's two spots ahead of Pac-Man, and then it'll draw a vector between Blinky and that spot ahead of Pac-Man, and then double it, and that's the tile, which you can see here. So this causes Inky to kind of take some very strange picks for his tile to target. And sometimes he'll be wildly off, and sometimes he'll be right there. In fact, I think because of the way this works, if Blinky is close to Pac-Man, Inky will usually be too. But if Blinky is further, Inky will usually be off doing his own thing. The next game I'm going to talk about is Creatures from 1996. It was an artificial life simulator modeling behavior, learning, genetics, biochemistry, etc. Tons of stuff this went over. Pretty impressive to hear about. I actually never played this game, but from what I can tell, it seems to be some kind of it's like playing The Sims with Furbies. Very strange. So the AI of Norns actually used a neural network made up of 952 neurons with about 5,000 connections between them, grouped into nine lobes. And the lobes included noun and verb, which the player could actually type into the game, commands and things. And so noun and verb are part of that, is how the Norn could take in that information. Concept, decision, attention, drive. Drive being things like hunger or loneliness, I think, fear, hunger, that kind of thing. Did I say hunger twice? Anyway. Perception, stimulus source, general sense. They could, if they were near an object, that would show up, that they would have a neuron associated with that object that they were nearby, if they could see it, and that neuron would increase in value. And the top neuron, like the top object with the highest value, would become the object of its attention. And the same was true of like drives, for instance. The hungrier it was, the more the hunger neuron would have a value, and it would then focus on that. So the connections between the neurons, in 1996, obviously hardware was limited. So the number of neuron connections was only around 5,000. Today, it would be in the millions if you built a proper neural network with connections between every neuron. Now, the connections were subject to three mechanisms, reinforcement, atrophy, and migration. So reinforcement increases or decreases the strength of connections depending on whether they had a positive or negative result. Connections that are sufficiently weak will atrophy to the point that they will migrate to other neurons. And players could also provide direct rewards and punishments. So I'll go over how this works in a second. This is a diagram of what Norn's brain kind of looks like. Each of these squares is a lobe. In the concept lobe, the neurons represent situations made up of a bunch of other neurons. The perception lobe acts as a container for values from four other lobes. And this was because of limitations in the system. Apparently, lobes could not be connected to more than a certain number of other lobes, so perception had to be kind of like they copied values from other lobes into it so that it could have multiple things going on at once. In this example, you see that there's the hunger drive is active. It can perceive food nearby, and because it's near them, they will have this situation as a concept, a neuron. And if the connection exists and is strong enough, the neuron will decide to eat food. So that situation in concept will push, or we'll create this neuron connection with push, which is apparently if they push food, they eat it in this game. Push was, I guess, kind of like a general use ability. So with the reinforcement system, when a Norn does something that results in something good happening, like for instance eating food when it's hungry, when hunger is satisfied, that will strengthen that connection. So that action that they took, eating the food, that becomes stronger. So they'll do that more often. But if they do something negative, like for instance, in the last slide I showed you the box art, the green guy there is a Grendel, sort of like an enemy to the Norns. So if a Norn approaches a Grendel, they have a fear drive, which will increase in intensity when they approach that Grendel. And so that negative result will cause them to not take that action as much. The next game I'll talk about is Fear. This was a horror shooter game. Half the game was being jump scared by this little girl ghost you can see in the cover there, and the other half of the game was fighting these soldiers. Fear is often lauded as having fantastic AI, as one of the best shooter AIs that they have out there. The soldiers could actually work together in some sense. They could, when you fight them, they would flank you. They would open up new fronts in the battlefield. They'd flush you out of cover with grenades. And you could hear them shouting to each other all the time, like constantly, kind of updating themselves, but the player also, on what they were doing and thinking. But Fear, like I told you, the finite state machine in Pac-Man, a lot of these often use finite state machines. Fear only has three, which is surprising. It's the same number that Pac-Man has. But the reason for that is because They Fear also uses a planning system based on strips, which is a it's an algorithm produced by Stanford Research Institute. This system is based on goals and actions. So the planning system tells each AI what their goals and actions are, and then the AI decides how to achieve the goal with the actions available. And here's an excerpt I found in a paper, which was very interesting. I'll just go ahead and read this. Imagine that we created a goal set which contains only two goals, patrol and kill enemy. When we assign this goal set to our soldier, he patrols through a warehouse until he sees the player, at which point he starts firing his weapon. If we place an assassin in the exact same level with the same goal set, we get markedly different behavior. The assassin runs cloaked through the warehouse, jumps up and sticks to the wall, and only comes down when he spots the player. He then jumps down from the wall and lunges at the player, swinging his fists. Finally, if we place a rat in the same level with the same goal set, we once again see different behavior. The rat patrols on the ground like the soldier, but never attempts to attack at all. What we are seeing is that these characters have the same goals, but different action sets used to satisfy the goals. The soldier's action set includes actions for firing weapons, while the assassin's action set has lunges and melee attacks. The rat has no means of attacking at all, so he fails to formulate any valid plan to satisfy the kill enemy goal, and he falls back to the lower priority patrol goal. So here you can kind of see how, you know, with these separate goals and action sets, you can really sort of just give them to the actors in the game, and they'll sort of, you know, move themselves almost. It's very impressive. The last thing with Fear is the squad. So again, like I mentioned, that they could work together. Apparently they have a global coordinator, sort of secondary AI, that is responsible for periodically grouping the soldiers into squads when they're close to each other. Now, this coordinator only actually has four simple squad behaviors that it can give to them. One is to move to any quarter cover while one lays suppression fire. Second is move to closer cover while one lays suppression fire. The third is to move to a point in single file while covering each other. And the last will actually cover the back and cover their rear. And the fourth behavior is to split into pairs who cover each other while searching the rooms. There's nothing actually more complex than these four behaviors defined specifically, but they actually perform more complex behavior because of the interplay between the squad and the individual AI that's going on. So there's this illusion that that there's something more going on, but there isn't. Now, the last game, another horror game, is called Alien Isolation. This one is based on the popular Alien movie franchise. And this game is, you play as Ripley's daughter, you're trapped on a space station, and you are running away from a single terrifying alien that is unkillable and will kill you in one hit if it catches you. So a lot of running around hiding from it, and the AI of the alien is carrying a lot of the game. Right, a lot of it hinges on the alien's AI. If the AI is bad, then the game will be bad. So they really had to do a lot for this one. Audio and visual cues, again, like I mentioned, that comes up a lot actually in Fear as well. They mention that the soldiers would call out things like if you kill every squad soldier except for one, that one will run away. And then he'll call out, "I need reinforcements," like he's calling into a radio. Apparently, there's no mechanism in the game for reinforcements. the illusion is that as the player advances through the level, they'll inevitably run into more soldiers. So it seems to them like the call for reinforcements worked, even though it didn't. So that kind of thing is, you know, you have very simple audio and visual cues to the player that makes them think that there's actual, you know, intelligence happening, that there's AI, when there isn't. So here again, the alien will, you know, have audio or visual cues which will cue the player into letting the aliens letting the player know about the alien's intentions and what they're doing. The alien will also perceive and investigate secondary sources of sound and movement. So what that means is if the player opens an airlock, and the alien hears that, and then it goes and investigates, and it doesn't see the player, it'll still understand that that's unusual, that the airlock doesn't open itself. So when it's hunting for the player, it'll build a list of spots to investigate based on like what it hears and what it's thinking and like likely spots that the main character might be hiding in. And it'll start checking these spots based on visibility. But it's not an optimal path. So because of that, it'll sometimes double back and like recheck areas. So to the player, it feels like the alien is like second guessing itself. You know, it's doubting its decision. It's going back and checking again. But this is just a result of you know, the list that it has based on prior visibility rather than an optimal path. The alien also has the illusion of learning and adapting to the player. The player thinks that as they play the game, the alien is learning, but actually it's using a behavior tree where parts of it are locked until the player survives an encounter and performs certain conditions. Then that behavior tree part will unlock, and then the alien will have new actions. So it seems like the alien is learning and adapting when they're not. The alien's AI is actually one that does not cheat by teleporting around. I think there's only two spots in the game where it teleports only to be in a cutscene. But during the gameplay, it never teleports and it doesn't cheat. It doesn't know where the player is. There's a secondary AI called the director, which helps the alien by giving it hints as to the player's location. So if the alien is like way off somewhere else in the station, the AI will prod the alien and say, hey, she's over here. And so the alien will go and check it out. So while the player is hiding, there's a menace gauge that increases as the player is under threat of being discovered. So when the alien is hunting around and moving around, checking the room, and the player's, you know, huddled, terrified in a locker, that gauge will fill. And when it reaches the max, the director will then prod the alien to go away. So that kind of gives the player some breathing room. And it kind of gives the illusion that, like, the alien has decided, you know, the player isn't here anymore or that they're somewhere else. So it goes off to search another place. So key takeaways from these four examples are that there are many ways to implement AI in games. Finite state machines and behavior trees come up a lot in game AI. Those are like the foundations of all this. But there are more advanced techniques like neural networks and strip splinters, which can help, you know, kind of bring it to the next level. But the most important thing with game AI is how the player is perceiving it. So smoke and mirrors is a huge part of it. You know, stuff that isn't even AI, just audio and visual cues, little things, little tricks, little hacks that the player make the player think that there's more going on than there is actually a huge part of it. Here are my references. There are some very, very interesting articles in here. I might point out the AI of creatures. There's a lot that I didn't explain about it due to time constraints, but there's that particular article has a very good write-up on it. It's also very interesting. I mean, 1996 technology making a neural network that's very interesting. If they did that today, it would probably be a lot better. Here's more. We've got stuff on some other things. There's plenty. All right. Thank you for listening. That's it for me.
Yeah, thank you. And I'm sure we have
questions.
Many gamers in here. Yeah. Any questions, guys and girls?
Great job, Zygmunt. I really enjoyed that.
Great. If anybody wants those links, you know, for light reading, just send me a message and I'll send them to you. Thank you.
All right. Well, thank you. And thank you, everybody. Great presentations tonight. I guess that'll be it for, unless I'll double check. But yep, that's everybody that I got on the list. So again, great job. And I'm going to stop the recording, but feel free to stick around and converse.
I like it, but I'm